The Get Out releases in cinemas nationwide on the 31st of July. An aging but formidable club owner named Manco has been robbed by a masked gunman, and his aspirations of retiring into the sunset alongside his girlfriend and selling his club appear more distant than ever. With cartel bosses breathing down his neck, a young upstart posing as the new guy in town, eager to purchase the clubs, and a Bonnie and Clyde-inspired duo hellbent on stealing everything he's got, Manco has to use every trick he's learned to get out alive with his lady friend and whatever cash he's got left. Starring Russell Crowe, Luke Evans, and Teresa Palmer, and directed by Derek Bort, The Get Out is in cinemas now. When Franz Richter bought a piece of land just outside Muldersdrift in the 1970s, he dreamt of creating a bubble of African paradise where guests could watch zebras graze while they ate their breakfast, and his family could thrive and live in peace and one day raise their own families there. And for decades, that is what Haya Safari Lodge was. Until one day in November 2007, when three gunshots changed everything. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 207, The Murder of Franz Richter. True Crime South Africa is an independent podcast and relies on listener support to keep going. There are many ways you can support the podcast. You can check out all of them at truecrimesouthafrica.com. The most impactful way is by joining True Crime South Africa exclusives on Patreon or Paybrew or Apple subscriptions or YouTube memberships. Among other benefits, you'll get free access to online TCSA events, exclusive episodes, discounts on my audiobooks, and ad-free episodes. So you don't have to listen to me say this every week. Listen through to the end of the episode where I discuss more ways you can help support the podcast. If you're a True Crime South Africa exclusives member, this case might sound familiar to you. I covered it for the first time way back in 2020. But as I've been setting up the exclusive episodes on so many new platforms lately, I've been revisiting some of these older episodes I did on that feed. And I realized that this one needed a complete do-over. I often say that I've changed a lot as a person through doing this work. And that is never more apparent to me than when I look back at some of the older episodes and see all the things I missed the first time round. Aspects that needed to be acknowledged and dissected a little more to really do justice to the case and its victims. So if you do remember listening to that episode way back when, this is not that episode. It's the same case, for sure. But it also has a ton of new information and a lot of context and perspective that I don't think I was equipped to provide the first time round. My sources for today's episode include Tanya Farber's book, Blood on Her Hands, the judgment and sentencing documents for the trial, and a few media sources. So let's get into episode 207, The Murder of Franz Richter.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information in our show notes.
Franz Richter was born in Romania in 1927. He was orphaned at the age of 5, and as a result, like many children at that time, had to grow up very quickly. By the age of 18, he was living alone in Germany and had already been made to serve in the German army in World War II. Franz had qualified as a motor mechanic, but in 1952, he saw an advertisement in a newspaper seeking men to mine gold in South Africa. They were looking for 80 men, and there were more than 1,000 applicants. Despite these odds, Franz was selected, and he boarded a ship almost immediately, bound for South Africa. Franz was contracted by the South African government to work in the mines of Johannesburg for a minimum of 4.5 years. Franz would never return to Germany, and he began to forge a life for himself in South Africa. He did, however, have a German pen friend, a young lady named Hedwig. The pair had been conversing by letter for some time, and Franz invited her to join him in South Africa. He sent her a ticket, and the young woman soon arrived in South Africa, with nothing but her sewing machine and a suitcase. Franz and Hedwig were married just 16 hours after she arrived in South Africa. Now, with a wife, Franz decided that gold mining was no longer an appropriate occupation and wanted to put his motor mechanic qualification to good use. Initially, he worked at several garages in Johannesburg and then soon opened his own business, Richter's Motors. The business would eventually grow to 4 garages, and Franz would also have a team at Kyalami Racetrack. Despite his enormous success in the motor industry, Franz was saving up for a bigger dream. He'd fallen in love with Africa and its bushveld and wildlife, and he wanted to purchase his own piece of land to start a safari lodge. In 1970, his dream became a reality when he purchased 1,100 hectares of land just outside Mulder's Drift. He and Hedwig had welcomed 2 daughters and a son at this point, and the entire Richter family moved to Mulder's Drift to start building their family business. It was slow going at first, but Franz managed to acquire a good amount of wildlife, built a lodge, and the Higher Safari Ranch began to build a reputation as a great place to go on game drives and spend a few nights in the bush. Family life was good for the Richters, and they spent many happy years running the lodge together. Sadly, in 1983, Hedwig Richter died suddenly, and Franz was left in mourning to run the lodge and raise his children on his own. He channeled his loneliness into running the business, and one of his now adult daughters remained at the lodge to help him with the tourism side. Franz had very specific ideas about what he wanted the lodge to be. He wasn't interested in taking part in the wedding industry that was starting to boom in Mulder's Drift at that time, although the lodge would later offer such services. He just wanted to be able to offer guests wildlife, a meal, and a bed. Hedwig had been the driving force behind the lodge's decor, and with her death, it seemed to go into a time capsule. No renovations were done, the restaurant didn't update its menu, and the food, although still palatable, was, by some accounts, a little boring. For Franz, though, the fact that his guests could sit and watch zebras drink at the watering hole while they ate their bacon and eggs more than made up for the lack of pizzazz. Franz did make some improvements to the lodge, those that he felt added to his overall vision for it. He knew that overseas visitors were always enthralled by experiences of authentic African culture, so he built a Zulu traditional village on the outskirts of the lodge. It was rather authentically created, and even opened by King Goodwill Zwelithini, the Zulu monarch at that time. The village offered traditional Zulu dancing performances as well as curio shops. Franz frequently travelled to KwaZulu-Natal to recruit dancers for the village. In addition to this, Franz also built one of the biggest hand-built stone dams on the African continent, and soon he was receiving multiple offers from investors to buy up his land. of course, he turned them down. He had no desire to sell off what he'd built, and he planned to run the lodge himself as long as he was able to. In 1987, 4 years after his wife's death, Franz would make a fateful trip to KZN to recruit new dancers for the Zulu village. Among the men and women that returned back with him on that trip was a 15-year-old girl named Siliwe Mbokazi. Siliwe was born on the 5th of September 1972 in Impangeni, KwaZulu-Natal. She spent the first 15 years of her life living in a rural village in KZN. Life was hard, and it seemed an unbelievable stroke of luck that this man would come from Johannesburg to choose men and women to perform the dances that were simply part of their culture, and that he would pay people to do it. It seemed an enormous opportunity for a young girl who likely would have had very few of those in her life. And when she caught Franz's eye and he asked her to join his team, she readily agreed. When I first read about this arrangement, I didn't feel great about it as a concept, I'll be honest. It was a time in South Africa's history when black people had very few rights and were highly susceptible to exploitation. This group of people being transported to a different province, far from their families and support systems, could have put them at serious risk if the person hiring them did not have good intentions. Siliwe, being a minor, also put her at further risk. But Franz's employees would all later say that they were very well taken care of, and that no one was taken against their will. In fact, all residents of the village eagerly awaited his arrival whenever he came. Franz apparently paid his staff well, and they were given comfortable lodgings and meals. He was also hiring men and women, so it wasn't like he was building a harem of young girls to dance for him. All of the employees at the lodge reported enjoying working there. When Siliwe was selected, she would likely have been over the moon. She would be able to send money back to her family in KZN, and she would be doing something she enjoyed. Franz had reportedly never had any inappropriate interactions with any of his employees, but he and Siliwe immediately seemed to click. Her twin brother joined her on the trip back to the lodge that day, and he would later say that it had become clear to him that Franz was enamored with the girl. Of course, there was an enormous age difference between the pair. Franz, at the time, was 60 years old, and Siliwe, just 15. It is unknown when the pair's relationship became intimate. At this time, the age of consent was 16, and regardless of how the story will end, we cannot deny that there is a major issue with an age gap of this size for many reasons. When Siliwe turned 23, she was invited to move into Franz's home on the lodge premises. This was 1995, and apartheid had just fallen. During apartheid in South Africa, interracial relationships were illegal. So it is likely that this is the reason that Siliwe did not move in before then. Even when she did move in, though, neither her nor Franz presented as a couple to those at the lodge. When Franz's daughter asked him outright whether they were in a relationship, he told her that Siliwe was his housekeeper. She was very clearly not just his housekeeper, though. And by the time this case would come before a court, no one was denying that Franz and Siliwe had been in a relationship for several years. Siliwe remained on the lodge's payroll, but it would also later be revealed that around the time Siliwe moved in with Franz, he had paid her family in KZN lobola for her. In African culture, lobola is paid by a man to the family of a woman he intends to marry. It is a way to start building relationships between families and is traditionally paid with livestock. In modern times, Lobola is more often paid with money. Lobola is a sign of commitment and indicates that for all intents and purposes, the couple is in a customary marriage. Franz had also committed to building a homestead for Siliwe in her home village in KZN. The pair started to bring children from the village to live with them in Mulder's Drift. I will not be naming these children to protect their rights to anonymity. The first of the children to move into Franz's home was Siliwe's 12-year-old niece, who had been involved in a horrific car accident in 2004 and moved in with Franz and Siliwe so that she could have access to medical care. Franz paid all of her medical bills. Another 11-year-old also moved in with the couple, and later on, three younger children came to live there too. The children's expenses were all paid for by Franz, and especially the older children came to see Franz and Siliwe as their father and mother. From Siliwe's perspective, her actual feelings for Franz are difficult to determine, and I think that it may have been less of a deeply romantic partnership and more of a pairing of convenience and benefits on both sides. Franz's loneliness would have been abated by once again having a female partner and young children in the house. Siliwe was certainly living a better standard of life than she would have, and as an added bonus, the children were being given a start in life they may otherwise not have had. For Siliwe, at least, there was a trade-off. Money is not everything, and she was a young woman who may have yearned for the passion of a relationship with someone closer to her age. We absolutely cannot overlook the vast difference in power dynamic in this relationship either. Franz was much older than Siliwe and had much more life experience. He was providing all of the money, and their interactions had started with Siliwe as his employee and as a minor. No matter what happens later in this case, this is a vitally important aspect to remember. It does not excuse anything criminal, of course, but pretending it doesn't exist is not helpful to anyone. It would appear that for the most part, Siliwe took the situation for what it was. Most would say that she'd never been particularly affectionate toward Franz and referred to him as the old man. Another consideration is that Siliwe and Franz were not open about their relationship. In fact, he initially outright lied to his daughter about the role Siliwe played in his life. It must be difficult to live a life partially ensnared in the shadows like that. And all of this pressure, these trade-offs and secrets, would come to a head in the most brutal of ways. In 2006, Siliwe had become involved in a secret relationship with a man who had previously worked at the lodge. Ronnie Kumalo had moved to Johannesburg in 2003, and he'd worked at the lodge for just 2 weeks before moving on to other employment. He maintained good relationships with those who worked at the lodge, though. Particularly, it appears, Siliwe Mbokazi. Ronnie was 28. And therefore far closer in age to Siliwe. Siliwe would later testify that around the time their affair had started, her sexual relationship with Franz had not been fulfilling due to his age. Ronnie and Siliwe would have secret trysts in the tool shed on the property of Franz's house, and one such meeting resulted in Siliwe falling pregnant. Although she would later deny that she had been particularly perturbed by her pregnancy, recognizing only, she claimed, that Franz would not be happy she was pregnant with another man's child, the truth of the situation would be revealed by other witnesses and the actions that she herself took during that time. Siliwe clearly understood that her entire lifestyle and that of the children was at stake. And in May 2007, she fled to the nearest town seeking an abortion. She unfortunately fell into the hands of a local chemical abortionist who was essentially a scam artist, who would take thousands of rands from women, give them a putrid concoction to drink, claim that it would cause an abortion, and then he would be nowhere to be found when the procedure did not work or made the woman violently ill. It soon became clear to Siliwe that she was still pregnant, and it would soon be impossible to hide. She knew she would have to tell Franz, and she reportedly told her sister that she was terrified to tell him. Before this admission would be made, though, something else happened, which would become pretty significant evidence of a premeditated plan. Between June and July, Franz started telling his secretary at the lodge, who had worked with him for years, that Siliwe had approached him about his will. He allegedly told the woman that Siliwe was concerned about what would happen to her and the children if he died, and he agreed that it was a good idea to put something in writing to provide for them in the event of his death. During that time, Franz legally amended his will and added a 1 million rand inheritance in the form of a trust for Siliwe, as well as a trust to the value of 500,000 rand for the children. In addition, he provided Siliwe with the legal rights to continue living in the farmhouse for the rest of her natural life, and his estate would pay for all amenities and upkeep of the home. Now, I will say that Siliwe would later deny that she knew anything at all about her and the children's inclusion in Franz's will. But Franz's secretary really had no reason to lie about this, and she related several conversations she'd had with the man about it, in which he was very clear that Siliwe had raised the matter and that he had made the changes to his will, and then he had informed Siliwe of such, and she was happy to have that peace of mind. If you're following along in the timeline here, these changes were made to Franz's will while Siliwe was pregnant with Ronnie Kamala's baby. But it was before she had advised Franz of such. Finally, in August 2007, with a burgeoning belly, Siliwe realized she would have no choice but to admit her infidelity to Franz. She would later claim that he was only unhappy that the baby was not his and hadn't been overly upset about her affair in general. The truth, though, appears to be that Franz was devastated by the news and told Siliwe that she would need to return to KZN when it was time to deliver the baby, and if she wished to return to Johannesburg after the birth, he would help find her work elsewhere. But she would not be welcome back at the lodge. It was decided that Siliwe would leave for KZN on the 16th of December. For a time, the fate of the five children was in question. Franz had become attached to them and did not want to let them go. But he had to acknowledge that he had no way of caring for five young children. And eventually, he told Siliwe that the children would have to leave with her. Faced with what was essentially the end of the life she had worked hard to build, rather than accept her fate, and perhaps angered at how the power dynamic was so harshly not in her favour, with her now essentially walking away from the relationship with nothing, Siliwe began to consider her options. On the 28th of November 2007, Franz Richter woke up to prepare for the day. It was payday at the lodge, and that meant that Franz would follow a decades-old ritual of going for breakfast at the restaurant, then meeting with the lodge secretary to collect the pre-packed pay envelopes. He would then call back to the house to let Siliwe know that he was on his way back. He would collect her, and they would drive out to the village the dancers lived at to pay them their wages. It was a routine they had followed every month since Siliwe had moved into the house with him. She knew it intimately, every move he would make, and every place that they would be, and exactly when. It would turn out that France's routine would be his undoing. Importantly, there was one thing that was very different about this payday from all the others. Usually, the lodge employees would be paid on the last working day of the month. So in November 2007, that would have been Friday the 30th of November. But Franz had other things lined up for the rest of the week, so he decided earlier in the month that this payday would be Wednesday the 28th instead. When Franz had finished his breakfast that morning, he collected the tin of envelopes from his secretary. He then called the house to let Seliwe know that he was on his way. She, in turn, readied the two older children who would be taking the trip with them. When Franz arrived in the old Land Rover, he was accompanied by one of his long-time employees, Terence. The young man was fiercely loyal to Franz. Seliwe got in front, and Terence and the children sat at the back of the vehicle. The Land Rover trundled off down the road, heading out to the village. There was a gate that needed to be opened, and it was customary for the children to open and close the gate for the vehicle. The Land Rover slowed, and the pair opened the gate, and the vehicle moved through and waited on the other side for the gates to be closed. Just as metal clanged against metal, though, three balaclava-clad men emerged from the bushes, armed with handguns. What happened next would seem like it took forever for some, and for others, happened in just an instant. Terence, standing at the gate, hesitated. Should he run for help? Would the men shoot him? Seliwe screamed. The men started shouting demands all at once. Seliwe offered the tin containing the money to them. No, they shouted. We want the man, not the money. They opened Siliwe's side of the vehicle and pulled her out onto the ground. She lay in the dirt, clutching her pregnant belly, as they grabbed her handbag and took her cell phone. Then, one of them fired what appeared to be a warning shot into the air. One of the children threw herself from the vehicle and started running. She would hear another two gunshots before taking cover behind a tree. Then the girl heard Seliwe wailing. She got up and ran back to her, grabbing the woman's arm and pulling at her to come with her. Both hid in the bushes until the three men were gone. Within minutes, the men fled the scene. Only dust mingled with the smell of gunpowder remained. A terrifying silence blanketed the scene until Terence and the other child started running to the lodge to call for help. Seliwe ran back too, alerting Franz's daughter, and brought the woman back to the scene where she had to witness the most horrifying of scenes. Franz remained in the vehicle. He was very still and not breathing. Blood was seeping through the white, short-sleeved shirt he donned that morning. The last two bullets that were fired went into his chest. A worker at the lodge, a man named Lendikaya, had been working just a few hundred meters away from where the vehicle was attacked. He too began to run back to the lodge to seek help. Along the way, a security guard alerted by Terence came running past. He told Lendikaya that he'd seen three men run off into the bushes, and both headed off in pursuit. He'd also pressed a panic button, and armed security arrived soon after. The three attackers had clearly had a very poor exit plan in the dense bush, though. They could not head back on the road, so they were attempting to pick their way down the mountainside when Lindikaya and the security members spotted them. Rather than give chase and risk a gunfight, they watched from the highest point and called police. Despite the closest police station being several kilometres away, the police still made it there while the three men were trying to gingerly pick their way down the mountain. When they spotted police, they started to run, and half fell, half stumbled their way insignia by bushes. The hunt was on. Back at the vehicle, Franz Richter was declared dead, and collection of forensic evidence and witness statements began. Everyone's story matched the evidence they found. The tin that had held the pay packets was found lying empty nearby. Despite the men's protests that they had wanted the man and not the money, in the end, they had taken both. The bush around the lodge was dense, and the search for the suspects was not easy. Police officers scoured the mountainside and valley on foot, helicopters scanned from the air, but the men seemed to have disappeared. Then some community members suggested that the men could be hiding in a large patch of dense reeds on a neighbouring farm. A risky decision was made. Rather than sending police into the reeds to an almost certain death at the hands of three armed assailants, police asked permission from the farm owner to set the reeds alight. They would smoke them out. Within 10 minutes of the fire being set, the first man emerged from the reeds. He was identified as Johnson Chedwa. He was 23 years old. According to details from the judgment later handed down, he had two siblings and left school after finishing grade 11 due to financial constraints at home. He was not married and was the father of two children who lived with their mother in the Free State. Johnson was a loan shark and a gambler at the time of his arrest, earning an income of about 4,000 rand per month. He contributed financially to the support of his children. When he was searched, wads of cash were found stashed all over him. The only time he complained that the money being taken was when a 50 rand note was taken out of his back pocket. That, he said, was his, and the police had no right to take it. Police also found a SIM card in Johnson's pocket, which would later be matched back to Siliwe's cell phone, which had been snatched by the men during the robbery. Police entered the reeds and found a second man lying flat on the ground. When he saw them, he tried to crawl away, but he was quickly taken into custody. He was identified as Gilbert Mosadi. He too was arrested. According to the judgment later handed down, he was born on the 12th of March 1976 in Zeerust, in the Northwest Province. He was from a family of five, not married, and had a three-year-old daughter who lived with her mother. At the time of his arrest, Gilbert Mosadi earned an income from selling perfume and from gambling. He did contribute financially to the maintenance of his child. The third perpetrator was nowhere to be found. But when Johnson was interviewed at the police station, he agreed to take police officers to the third man. In a local informal settlement, police arrested Dumisani Zulu. Zulu, the others contended, was in fact the leader of the group and the one who had recruited the others. According to details in the judgments, he was born on the 6th of April 1970 in Ishowe, KwaZulu-Natal, which he considered his permanent home, and that is where his family, a wife and three children, aged 11, 7 and 3 at the time, lived. His wife was employed and two of their three children attended school. Zulu came to Johannesburg in 2006 in search of employment. He was employed at Hire Safari for a while, but he was unemployed at the time of his arrest. The question remained, though, how did this plan come about, and where was it hatched? The answer to that question would start to develop during the initial questioning of the three men. Up front, I should probably tell you that all three men would make confessions to being involved in the murder and robbery of Franz Richter, but all three would later retract those confessions and claim that either they'd been assaulted or the versions in the confessions had been detailed by a police officer and they had been forced to agree to it. Information from Dumisani Zulu, though, soon led to a fourth arrest. Ronnie Kumalo, Siliwe's lover, and the father of her unborn child, was arrested just a few hours later. Zulu had claimed that Khumalo had been involved in the murder plot. The pair knew each other as they'd grown up in the same village in KwaZulu-Natal. Already, at this point, police had a fifth suspect in their sights as a result of information from Zulu, but they needed to gather more evidence. After an autopsy and his remains being released to his family, Franz Richter was buried beside his first wife, Hedwig, on the Lodge property on the 3rd of December 2007. His daughter said that his motto had always been, "Live in Africa with Africa." Siliwe stood at his graveside with her swollen belly, tears running down her face. Within a few days, she would make a strange remark to a young friend who worked at the lodge. She told the woman that she was afraid that police were about to arrest her. Richter's daughter had taken charge of running the lodge and was working through the phone records so that she could bill guests for any phone calls they'd made during their stay, when she stumbled across the records for the phone in her father's home. She noticed a few numbers that she didn't recognize. These numbers had been called from the house landline multiple times in the run-up to her father's murder. The woman handed these records over to the police. It would soon be revealed that the number most frequently called in the run-up to Franz's murder belonged to Dumisani Zulu. Considering the link between Siliwe and Ronnie Khumalo, and the further link between Khumalo and Zulu, it was rather easy to infer that these calls had probably been made by Siliwe. In fact, on the day of the murder, six calls were made during the time that Franz was preparing for the wage run, which meant that there was no way that it was anyone other than Siliwe. The children were the only other people in the house at that time. Zulu was happy to talk to police. He was not going down alone, and admitted outright that he had acted in cahoots with Siliwe. Siliwe's comments to her young friend about fearing arrest would seem almost prophetic when on the 7th of December she was handcuffed and placed into a police vehicle at the farmhouse. She was under arrest for the murder of Franz Richter, the man she had deemed her husband. Unlike the first three arrested suspects, Siliwe was not making any confessions, and she denied everything. She denied that she told anyone she feared she was going to be arrested, and also claimed that she knew nothing about being in Franz's will, and denied that she'd been the one phoning Dumisani Zulu. In her initial statements, within hours of the murder, Siliwe had actually told police that she had recognized Dumisani as being one of the assailants, even though he'd been wearing a balaclava. Zulu had already been arrested by this point, so her evidence would really just have been something they could use at trial. It did seem odd that the woman would be able to identify a man she claimed not to know particularly well, even with a balaclava on. But it's also important to note that among the first four men arrested, two had been ex-employees of the lodge. The vast majority of violent robberies on rural properties like this involve employees or ex-employees of the property or owner. So, as the crime had presented itself up front, the four men they had in custody made absolute sense, initially, with what police would have expected. Robbery was the motive, and murder had occurred in the process. If it wasn't for those phone calls between Siliwe and Dumisani, and also some comments Dumisani made about him understanding that if Franz died, Siliwe would inherit the lodge, police might never have dug further than those first four arrests. Because there didn't really seem to be any loose ends. It was the tragic reality of how many South Africans lose their lives. Except now, there seemed to be an even deeper motive. And clearly, this wasn't just a robbery gone wrong. Those who had planned this had always intended for Franz Richter to be killed. Siliwe claimed that the calls from the farmhouse landline and from her own cell phone, it emerged, to Dumisani Zulu had actually been made by Ronnie Khumalo. She said he had visited her at the house when Franz was out. The call started on the 2nd of November and continued through the months right up until the morning that Franz was murdered. Ronnie, likely not wanting his baby to be born in prison, attempted to claim that he had indeed made the calls from both Siliwe's cell phone and the landline, but said that the calls were just chats between friends, and occasionally Dumisani had been asking to borrow money from Ronnie. He claimed that he'd been in the house on the morning of Franz's murder, and he had been the one who'd been in contact with Dumisani after receiving a missed call from him. They discussed 300 rand that Dumisani wanted to borrow from Ronnie. The two older children testified that they had been in the house on the morning of the murder, and they had not seen Ronnie Khumalo at the house at all. In addition, neither child said that they knew Ronnie as a person who visited the house, and they'd never seen him using the phone inside. They also said that that morning, when Franz had arrived and hooted to let them know to come outside, they'd immediately gone out to the vehicle. But Siliwe had been on the phone, and she'd taken quite a while to come outside. This timing coincided with the final call made from the landline to Dumisani's cell phone, just before the murder was carried out. With five individuals now charged with involvement in Franz's murder, his friends and family looked forward to the trial beginning as soon as possible. Siliwe gave birth to her baby while incarcerated, but was granted bail not long after. Early in 2008, though, before the trial could start, another person was arrested in connection with the case. The individual had actually been mentioned in the original confessions of the first three men arrested, but they hadn't known his real name, and it had taken some time to track him down. The man was a warder at a nearby prison. He would become accused number six when the trial started in 2008. When final charges against the six were read out, it became clear that something new had been added to the charge sheets of the first three men arrested, Chirwa, Zulu, and Mosadi. In addition to the murder and robbery charges, the men were charged with attempted bribery. A police officer who worked at the court regularly had pulled the investigating officer on the case aside one day, quite early on in the proceedings, and had told him that the three accused had attempted to bribe him to steal the dockets and dispose of it. Instead of outright refusing, he'd played along, and between him and the IO, they got recorded evidence of the bribe offer. When the trial finally got underway, it would prove a frustrating process for the family. The judgment document in this case is 214 pages long, and the first 100 pages of that is dedicated solely to the multiple trials within a trial which were held to ascertain the admissibility of evidence. Chief among this were all of the admissions made by all of the accused. The first three men claimed that not a word of their confessions were true, and they had nothing to do with the crime. The other three accused claimed that they hadn't understood their rights, or that the admission attributed to them was not their words. Now, it would soon become clear that there certainly had been some communication between some of these accused after their arrests, and it appears that the initial attempt to get rid of the docket was the first way out they'd sought. And after that failed, it seemed they may very well have colluded to get their confessions thrown out by all claiming some version of the same story, which could make their admission inadmissible. Now, I'm not saying that confessions have never been assaulted out of an accused person before. We absolutely know that this does happen, unfortunately. But they were very senior officers on this case. And as they would eventually testify in court, they were not going to risk their careers to assault three men who had pretty much been caught red-handed anyway. In addition, all the stories the men told about their alleged assaults at the hands of police seemed very similar. And yes, that could be because they were all assaulted in a similar way. But it's more likely that it's because they all came up with the same story together. Johnson Chirwa and Gilbert Mosadi claimed that on the day in question they had been in the field where they were caught because they were smoking dacha. And when they'd seen police, they'd hidden because they were scared they were going to be arrested because they smelled like dacha. They could not explain why, when the field was set alight and they became overwhelmed with smoke, they continued to hide. As for the money found on them, the men claimed they'd won it gambling, and Chidwa claimed that the police had planted Siliwe's SIM card on him. Dumisani Zulu also claimed that he had nothing to do with the murder, and that his initial confession had been beaten out of him. Chirwa and Mosadi, though, had been caught within meters of the premises. Add to that the SIM card and the bundles of money found on them, plus their knowledge of Dumisani Zulu being involved and him being very clearly linked to what had taken place, meant that there was quite a mountain of evidence against the men. The fact that they had attempted to get rid of the dockets also did not look good. When the firearm and ballistics evidence was presented, additional pieces fell into place. The autopsy showed that Franz Richter had been shot at three times by two different caliber bullets, a .38 and a 9mm. Two of those had struck him, and one had gone into the seat behind him. In his initial confession, which he would later refute, Dumisani Zulu told police that the men had been armed with a .38 and a 9mm that day. This information was entered into the record long before the bullets had been checked for caliber, and long before Franz Richter's autopsy. No one knew what firearms had been used in the murder at that point, so it's impossible for that information to have been inserted in a setup unless it was a really good guess. Dumisani Zulu confirmed that he had known Franz Richter after having worked for the man for a while in 2006. He said in his statements that he knew Richter to be a good man who had helped many people in the area. Siliwe pleaded not guilty to all the charges against her. She said that she had not planned Franz's murder and she had no idea he was going to be killed that day. She did sort of throw Ronnie under the bus, though, when she claimed that the day before the murder, Ronnie had phoned her and asked when the lodge workers were getting paid that month. She said that she thought he wanted to know because he wanted to borrow money from her. But she said that must have been how the men got the information about when payday was happening. Now, that could be feasible, if it wasn't for one thing. She claims Ronnie asked her what time, and she'd said 10:30. Firstly, that is a weirdly specific thing to ask if you just want to borrow money from someone. And secondly, the men clearly did know what time to be at the gate, even though Franz was running slightly later than usual that day. Ronnie Kamala also insisted that he was innocent on all charges against him. He would only continue to claim that he had been the one to make most of the calls to Dumisani Zulu from the farmhouse and Siliwe's cell phone. But when presented with a list of all the calls made to that number, he could not confirm that he had made every single call. Other than that, he denied any role in the murder. Siliwe and Ronnie appeared to remain in a relationship despite their imprisonment, and their daughter was already 18 months old when the crux of the trial was ongoing during 2009. The five children who had considered Franz a father figure were returned to the KwaZulu-Natal village from which they'd come. Franz's daughter, as the executor of his will, had agreed that they should still receive money from the trust fund he'd set up for them, and as such, their caretakers were paid out an amount for each child until they turned 18. In their testimony, the two older children had frequently referred to Franz as their father. Finally, more than 2 years after the murder of Franz Richter, judgment was handed down to the six accused. Ronnie Kamalo and the sixth accused person were both found not guilty of all the charges against them. The judge found that because the only evidence linking both to the crime was the accusation of the other three men, and those confessions were now in dispute by the men themselves, there was insufficient grounds to find the men guilty. Kumalo certainly would have shared a motive with Siliwe to have Franz murdered, in that he too would have gained financially and personally from the man's death. But this, along with any possible phone calls he may have made to Dumisani Zulu, was the only circumstantial evidence which could also plausibly be explained in a way that didn't point to his guilt. Siliwe Mbukazi, Dumisani Zulu, Johnson Chirwa, and Gilbert Mosadi were all found guilty of murder and robbery. Chirwa and Mosadi were additionally found guilty of attempting to bribe the police officer to lose the docket. Later that month, all four were handed down a life sentence each for the murder of Franz Richter. They will be eligible for parole in 2035. Sadly, Franz's murder would have a myriad of consequences for his family and all those who'd worked at Higher Safari Lodge. One of his children contested his will several times in court, until the other eventually had to ask the court to grant them protection against vexatious litigation. This continued in the courts right up until 2017. By that time, though, more tragedy had befallen the family on the very same land. Franz's oldest daughter had continued to run the lodge and live there along with her daughter. Her ex-husband, Paul Schulter, had also joined the team to help run the lodge. Then, on the 2nd of April 2013, history repeated itself in the most horrendous of ways. Paul Schulter was robbed and shot to death in front of the farmhouse at the lodge. In 2007, Siliwe had run back to the lodge and brought Franz's daughter down to witness the scene of his death. And 6 years later, Franz's granddaughter was the one to discover her own father's body. There is very little information online about any investigation into Paul Schulter's murder, and I have not found anything to indicate that arrests were made or anyone was prosecuted. At the time, Franz's daughter said she remained committed to the lodge and refused to let her father's dream die because of senseless violence. But by 2015, the lodge had been sold, and online blog posts wished Franz's family well as they moved into their new phase of life. The new owners have renamed the lodge Cradle Moon, and the dam Franz Richter hand-built remains there to this day and is sometimes used for Midmar qualification events. The dam remains named the Franz Richter Dam. When approaching this case again almost 6 years after I'd looked at it for the first time, although I continued to do so with the victim-focused lens, I now better understand what lies beneath the murky world of crime. And I am a lot more comfortable with the knowledge that someone being a victim of a violent crime does not mean that they were a perfect person. In fact, it is this idea that we continue to pursue, that victims have to be unblemished souls who always lit up a room and always did the right thing, that is, in my opinion, what detracts from true representation for victims. Both things can be true. You can be a victim of crime, and you can also have done some stuff in your life that deserves addressing. The other side of this is that I've also come to learn that not all perpetrators of crime are evil to the core and deserve no acknowledgements of their own suffering. Because acknowledgements, whether it's of a victim's flaws or a perpetrator's own trauma, does not excuse a crime in any way. But I've come to learn that it could help to explain it. And if we truly want to reduce violent crime in our country, then acknowledging the contributing factors is vital. As I'm preparing to release this episode, there's a story in the news about a farmer in the Free State who's been advertising for a second wife, who he's offered to pay exorbitant amounts of money to bear him an heir. All of that is quite wild as it stands, but it's the age range he's requesting applicants to fall within that has really shocked most people. 16 to 25. The man in question is 58. My immediate reaction to that was revulsion and fear that a young girl could be caught up in a situation like this because she is nowhere near mature enough to make a lifelong commitment of this extent, and also how deeply the power dynamics would be out of her favor. This man would hold all the cards. That age gap is almost exactly the same as between Franz and Siliwe. I recognize that we don't know for sure when their relationship became intimate, but it's just something we cannot look away from. Is it at all possible for someone to grow up with a normal, healthy outlook on life when their very early formative years have been shaped by a deeply skewed relationship like this? And I say this regardless of gender. I would have the same questions if Siliwe had been a boy child of 15 and Franz had been a woman of 60. I have seen myself just how much damage these huge age gap interactions have on both boys and girls as they grow up. Yes, it was normal in the early 1900s, but we know better now, and we should absolutely be doing better. Although the skewed power dynamic relationship details were mentioned in the court documents, it was never mentioned in a context of examination. Now let's be clear, the nature of the relationship between Siliwe and Franz and how and when it started does not in any way make her less guilty of murder. By the time she did what she did, she was an adult who was more than capable of making better choices. It would, however, have changed the way she made those decisions, and her lawyer could have tried to present that as a mitigating factor in sentencing. Did she deserve less time? Probably not. What she did was pretty cold-blooded, and how much it contributed would always be a matter for expert witnesses and a judge to decide anyway. But it would be an important aspect to address in terms of rehabilitation, because if we're attempting to rehabilitate the patterns of thought that led to murder, then we need to understand where all those patterns of thought came from. The other side of this is Franz, who undoubtedly, at least in the beginning, had some level of desire to hide his relationship with Siliwe. Was this because of the age gap, or because she was an employee, or maybe even initially because of them being a biracial couple? Who knows? His family seemingly had no problem with the relationship by the time he died. His daughter advocated for the children who'd been living with him. Human beings are layered and deeply complex. One of his own murderers told a court what a good man he thought Franz was. and he undoubtedly did do a lot of good in his community and loved and cared for the wildlife and human beings at the lodge. His family miss him deeply. He did not deserve to die. You'll notice that I have not named Franz's children or grandchildren in this episode, even though their names are easily accessible online. I've done so because I cannot even imagine how much everything they've gone through has impacted them. And if I can do one small thing by not re-advertising their identities here, then I'll do that. There is an alternate universe, perhaps, where Siliwe had chosen to move back to KZN with Ronnie and raise their daughter together in a healthier, more evenly matched relationship, where she could begin to grow as a woman and a person, where she would surely miss all the aspects of life at the lodge with a relatively wealthy man, but where she would also have all the things money could not buy. Her own child to raise, a home to call her own, and a partner who matched her stage of life. But that wasn't the choice she made. She, as a fully grown adult, made a decision to end the life of someone else, and several other people happily did her dirty work for her. Who knows what else that sliding doors moment could have impacted for everyone else in the future. Would Paul Schulter still have died the way he did? Would the Richter family still own the lodge? At least one child would not have grown up without a mother in that version of events. And the other five children would have been raised with a lot more opportunities. They too lost a man they considered their father figure. And who knows what impact that has had on those children and what that might have meant for their futures. It started with a child leaving her home at 15. Another child having been orphaned at the age of 5. And their worlds colliding. And it ended with more children paying the price for the adults' decisions. Franz Richter, Paul Schulter, rest gently. For more victim-focused true crime content, please follow True Crime South Africa on the app you're using to listen right now. I also have another podcast you might like called I Lived Through This. Follow the podcast on social media platforms for updates on new episodes, my books, and events I attend across the country. If you'd like to support the podcast and grab some True Crime South Africa branded merch, head over to sacriminologist.co.za now. You can stock up on a wide range of true crime themed merch, including tumblers, stickers, pens, mugs, and so much more. Use the code TCSA at checkout and you'll get a site-wide discount of 10%. In case you don't know, I'm also a true crime author with 4 published books: Samurai Sword Murder, Sizzlers, Killer Stories, and Bare Bones, which is also published in Afrikaans as Klipkoot. All of your support for the podcast and the victims of crime in South Africa is greatly appreciated. I'll be back with another episode before you know it. Until then, thank you so much for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.